Good evening, and welcome to this evening's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club of California and the Northern California Peace Corps Association. I am Will Sparger, a member of the club's International Relations Forum, president of the Northern California Peace Corps Association, and your chair for today. We also welcome our online and radio listeners, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight, we have five special guests, recently returned Peace Corps volunteers who served in diverse regions around the Ukraine. They will be discussing the lives they shared with their host communities. Their everyday interactions put a human face on the peoples, young and old, in the East and West, living in a country facing an uncertain future. Dave Masterson was a Peace Corps volunteer in Debaltseve in eastern Ukraine from 2005 to 2008. More recently, he was an English language fellow at Sevastopol National Technical University from 2012 to 2013. He studied Russian as an undergraduate and speaks fluent Russian, and he spent a semester in Ukraine before joining Peace Corps. Kayla Trunacek served as a youth development specialist at a boarding school for foster children in the small town of Korki, about 10 hours west of Kiev by train. Kayla served in one of the last groups of Peace Corps volunteers in Ukraine. Recently, video from her Peace Corps swearing-in ceremony was broadcast on Russian TV, which makes for an interesting story she can tell you about in a minute. Julia Lee served in Putivl in northeastern Ukraine from 2011 to 2013. There she trained English language educators, built youth development programs, and connected local communities with international education initiatives. She also collaborated with Grassroots Soccer and the Elton John AIDS Foundation, working on educating youth about HIV and AIDS. Brooks Harrison served as a youth development volunteer from 2010 to 2012 in the town of Kisharivka in northeastern Ukraine near the border with Russia. A few months after completing his service, he joined Peace Corps again as a teacher trainer at a university in Kiev until Peace Corps was evacuated in February of 2014. This April, he returned to Ukraine, this time on his own, visiting friends in the East and West to get a firsthand perspective of current events. Morgan Roth is an East Bay native and a Cal Poly graduate. She interned as a rehabilitative mentor for youth on probation before joining Peace Corps in 2011. From 2011 to 2013, she served at a boarding school and orphanage in the small town of Kremenets in the western part of Ukraine, developing after-school programs for students who lived in the dormitory. Now, before we begin the discussion, I want to emphasize that Peace Corps generally tells volunteers to try to stay as apolitical as possible during their service, which is somewhat of a challenge being put in a country that has so much politics going on as in Ukraine. So I'm going to just throw it to the panel here, maybe start with Morgan since she's the closest, to tell us a little bit about, during your training, what kind of instructions Peace Corps gave to you about engaging in political discussions.
Okay, so I remember in training, the main thing was they were like, don't join protest, stay away. Whenever there'd be a protest, they would be like, there's a protest going on in Kyiv, we recommend you not go there, avoid it at all costs. If you do need to go to Kyiv, let us know, stay safe kind of thing. They also say, like, I mean, for normal conversations, if you're having a cup of tea or a cup of coffee with your host family, you can talk about politics, but they say to kind of stay neutral, which I was really good at because I'm quite apolitical.
So. Yeah, very similar situation to Morgan. I think what I remember most is people will ask you, what do you think about the Ukrainian president? And then most of the time, you just feign ignorance, like, I don't know, you tell me, what do you think? That was like my main strategy for dealing, just like evading the question and, you know, giving them time to speak, because it's nice to hear Ukrainians speak their own opinion when they feel open enough with you.
Yeah, when I got to Ukraine, it was right after the Orange Revolution in 2004. And so we had the same, you know, instructions not to go to any protests, not to join anything, don't wear any orange, especially for since I was in the East. Just like Julia said, you know, a lot of people talked about politics all the time and wanted to know what I thought about American politics or the Ukrainian politics. And I'm a political science major, so I had a lot to say, but I tried to, you know, keep a fair, balanced opinion.
Just to kind of add on to what everyone else said, I had a really similar experience. When I started my training in 2010, it was kind of, I guess, what's going to be looked upon in retrospect as a really calm period in Ukrainian history. The Orange Revolution was, half a decade prior. Yanukovych had just been elected for the first time. It wasn't just a very political environment. Peace Corps, obviously, you know, like they said, they told us to remain as apolitical as possible. The smartest thing is just to never participate in a discussion, kind of deflect questions with the, you know, what do you think, or I don't really know enough about it kind of thing. I think where I really got the perspective about the political situation in the country was just from being in a host family. And kind of to know their opinions, the things they talked about, and that kind of gave me my first kind of, radar or meter to kind of gauge the country's mood about the things you didn't see on the surface, but the things people talked about kind of around the kitchen table.
Yeah. And so I was in Ukraine when the Euromaidan protests started back in November, and so Peace Corps kept us updated as far as making sure we were staying safe in our villages and making sure we weren't attending those protests, because you never know what direction they can turn. So we were supposed to remain apolitical as much as possible, and I had students showing up at my door asking for blue and yellow markers to make posters for the protest. So, with that, I told them they could make posters, but it's up to them to use their creativity on how they use it.
Thank you. So, Kayla, on the end here, I mentioned the video that was broadcast on Russian TV about your swearing-in ceremony. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. So it surfaced a couple months ago on Russian media that they showed pictures of our swearing-in ceremony back in June of last year, so almost a year later, and they said that the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine brought in over 100 volunteers to start the Euromaidan protest. And so they were using pictures from our swearing-in ceremony to used against his propaganda. I'm sorry? It was on Russian media, so, yeah.
So the next question I'd like to ask you is, how did people, you all represent very diverse regions of Ukraine. Morgan, you served in the West, and Kayla served in the West. And our three panelists, Julia and David and Brooks, served in the East. Could you tell us a little bit of, which is generally considered in our media when we simplify it, that that's the Russian part and the West is the Ukrainian part. Could you tell us a little bit about how people in your communities identify themselves? Well, I guess to start with you, Morgan.
My town was very pro-Ukrainian. Every national holiday, my town celebrated it. Fully, you know, the tables were set, like it was a huge party. Every single holiday was big. And so I thought the whole entire country was like that until I call up my Eastern friends and I'm talking about what I'm doing for holidays. Parades, dressing up in Vishnevankas, which is traditional Ukrainian attire. And my fellow Peace Corps volunteers in the East have no idea what I'm talking about. So, they're very nationalistic. Everyone spoke Ukrainian. That's it.
And Julia?
So, I've lived in the Northeast, and we have a Lenin statue, who I officially, you know, I call him Grandpa Lenin. We all do. How we felt is kind of split. We were split between generations. The new generation grew up as Ukrainian, so they learn Ukrainian, and they speak it, and they're fully supportive. but the older generation definitely spent time during the Soviet Union. They experienced the Soviet Union lifestyle that brought them benefits, apartments. So there's a basic call to that place and time when they experienced a great life, but then they received independence and they were unable to build their own town infrastructure. So it's definitely split between generations. The older generations believe that they were still Russian. The newer generation saw their parents think like that, but tended to be more Ukrainian, and they're the ones who are actually fighting for independence now.
In my town, definitely, like Julia said, the older generation had a lot of nostalgia for the Soviet Union just because of the stability. You know, people had jobs, people had pensions, they could take vacations, they could afford things. And then in the last 20 years of, you know, a lot of instability and chaos in the government and civil society, a lot of the older generation just kind of became disillusioned with how things were going. That being said, they didn't, no one I met really identified themselves as Russian. They just talked about the better time they had during the Soviet Union. I mean, people who were educated and knew things about Russia said that they wouldn't, you know, want to live in Russia either. Not that it was any better there. But like Julia said, the younger generation grew up in Ukraine, speaking Ukrainian. You know, they identified themselves as Ukrainian, but just because of the, you know, the chaos and instability and the, a lot of the stresses that the parents, the older generations were dealing with, you know, that was reflected and passed down to the younger generations, and, you know, they could see that there's problems and issues, and, you know, so they were kind of struggling with that.
Yeah, you know, just like he said, you know, I came from a region where Russian was definitely the preferred tongue over Ukrainian. And it's kind of been interesting to me since, you know, since the Maidan protests and forward from that, how most media, not just the American media, but basically the whole Western non-Russian media has kind of really keyed in on the East versus West, Russian versus Ukrainian language. And almost making that like, you know, that basically defines someone's identity. In my experience, even though I was in a almost 100% Russian-speaking place, I never really encountered anyone who said that they just wished they could be part of Russia or they preferred to be identified as Russian rather than Ukrainian. So, you know, I never really, even though I kind of had that impression going in as well, I learned that you know, there's a lot of different things in Ukraine that people look to for identity. A lot of it is, you know, history-based, like Morgan was speaking about, tradition-based. It's not so much language-based. I think the language has almost to a degree been something that's been politicized more recently and stigmatized to a degree also.
I just want to mention one thing that Morgan said initially about the traditions and the customs, because I knew a little bit about Ukrainian, you know, traditions and, like, you know, the sewing and the dances and songs like that when I got there. And the people in the East didn't really celebrate any of those traditions. And I think the main reason after I, you know, getting to know people and talking with people is that the East is the industrialized region. And people move there from all over of Ukraine and somewhat of the Soviet Union, but mostly from Western and Central Ukraine. And basically they were there just to work. I mean, they were like working class. I mean, you think of, like, you know, Pittsburgh back in, like, the 70s and 80s. I mean, this is, like, real working class, blue collar. And, you know, they didn't really get to keep those traditions alive as much. I mean, some people would remember them or talk about them back when they were a child, you know, in Central Ukraine. And I knew older people who were actually from Central Ukraine who had been sent there during the Soviet Union to work. But, like, during this, you know, during the Soviet Union, they kind of lost those traditions.
Yeah, actually, yeah. Just to say one quick thing about holidays, festivals, and traditions. Actually, the in the more eastern and southern region of Ukraine, the biggest observed holiday, not really Ukrainian national holidays, but the biggest observed holiday is Victory Day, celebrating in the Second World War. Yep. And that kind of builds on what he's saying about the region. Is it was a working class region, it's an industrial region, and since the collapse of the Soviet Union, it's kind of turn into maybe a slightly decaying rust belt where there's not as many opportunities for unskilled workers as there once were. And I think it's the nostalgia, especially for, you know, maybe the Stalin-era communism where they felt like they were part of this great thing. And you still even hear this language today being used to talk about the conflict in the East, is that, you know, they're kind of carrying on the tradition, and this generation is kind of showing, you know, is it up to muster for what was their greatest generation, which is you know, the same as our greatest generation in the United States, really, the people who lived in the 30s and 40s.
Kayla, do you have anything like that?
Yeah, you know, it would be funny because I would call my best friend in Peace Corps who lived 16 hours across the country over in western Ukraine, and I'd be like, hey, happy holiday, whatever it was, and she said, what holiday? And so, you know, there are a lot of exchanges like that where it was almost living in two separate countries in the sense of just different schedules and different languages and differences that way.
But even with the different, now I've talked to Julia and interviewed for her for stories before, but you said even though people would speak Russian, you said there was a very strong sense of identity of being Ukrainian, even though they were speaking Russian.
Exactly. I think my town was very historical. There's like traces of it in Ukrainian folklore and poetry. So there is that sense of pride, but there's also that dichotomy. Like they experienced such a great lifestyle, as David was mentioning, during the Soviet Union. So those who got to go to university, who got the pensions, there's definitely that conflict. But at the same time, there's still a sense that I am from Putivo, a historical town. My town is written in the Yaroslava song in Prince Igor, epic ballad, and we are Ukrainian, but it's a dichotomy that's hard because the Soviet Union represents so much success, and Ukrainian history just has so much oppression and negative feelings that it's difficult to be proud in a nation that's constantly in conflict.
Yeah. So that brings me to my next question I want to ask. Did people discuss politics with you? I mean, you were there for 2 years. It seems hard to have avoided it for two full years, or even some of you longer than that. Did people discuss politics, and what did they say, especially as the Euromaidan protests started gaining steam? Let's start with Kayla.
Sounds good, yeah. Of course, with the escalating situation in Ukraine, politically, going to school, you know, I'd show up to go to school and school would be canceled because everybody at our school was going to protest in the center of our city. And so with that, you know, you have all the kids asking you, hey, Kayla, come protest with us. And then I say, no, I can't. And then people starting conversations that way. Why? Do you not want to support us? Do you not want to come help us? And, you know, I think all throughout there were just different people I'd run into on the street or my neighbors and checking in with them. And they'd always ask what I thought about what was going on, and trying to remain neutral was rather hard to do.
I guess from a, you know, historical perspective and a perspective of personal experience, I was really fortunate to be working in a university in Kyiv from the time of the Euromaidan protests. In the early days, it was really interesting, and I actually did talk to my students about politics just to try to gain a perspective on what was going on. It definitely wasn't a national news story at that point, so really the only news about it in the country was regional or even national, kind of on a smaller level. So, you know, in the early days, it definitely wasn't really widespread, even among the kind of younger, educated group of students. In the beginning, I remember I actually had several students who were in the protests, and I had several students that showed up for Party of Regions anti-protests for money, just because they're students and it was a good way to get money, was to show up for the anti-protests. And as it moved along, I kind of saw the shift from, you know, someone being apathetic, some of them, you know, realizing that the counter-protest was like a way to make some easy money, to everyone kind of shifting towards the Euromaidan camp. And I guess, you know, the discussions I engaged in, you know, I tried very hard, you know, to remain as apolitical as possible. I definitely didn't want to try to push anyone in a direction they weren't heading in, but I definitely used that as a resource to gain as much knowledge about what was actually going on kind of at the ground level.
You were there more recently. I was there from 2005 to 2008, so this, I mean, none of this was happening. It was right after the Orange Revolution, and initially, people were kind of excited. There was kind of this air of, you know, jubilance, and people were kind of really expecting something to happen, you know, because people had went out and protested, and, you know, they had kind of gotten victory, and they were expecting change, and the politicians had promised something. This would be interesting. I don't know if any of you heard about this or people talked about this in other parts of the country, but especially in the East and in my area. People quickly became very disillusioned. I mean, the difference between just the feeling of people in the East between 2005 and 2008 when I left, you know, it definitely went downhill in terms of just what people thought of politicians and politics in general, just because they really thought that something was going to happen, and there would be maybe some stability, and you know, they would try and fight corruption, and life would somehow get better finally, and then things just got worse. And so, you know, people talked about politics all the time, but basically it was just to criticize and wave their hands and say, no one's going to help us, and you know, we're kind of just surviving out here.
That's an interesting question, Dave, that I wanted to follow up on. So do you think that there's seeds of the current unrest in the disillusionment with the Orange Revolution?
Yeah.
Like people, okay, we're tired and this didn't work, so we're going to try to...
Well, I mean, the problem is that there's the entire system is broken. I mean, the entire system is corrupt. And I mean, if you go now and read, you know, if you go on social media and look at what people are talking about, for example, in the town I was a Peace Corps volunteer, there's still bombing. It was bombed two days ago, even though there's the ceasefire. You know, people are angry at everyone. They blame everyone. They blame the Ukrainians. They blame the Americans. They blame the Russians. They blame the EU. They blame each other. You know, it's really starting. There's just a lot of like infighting now. You know, if you look at like the social media. So I definitely think there was the seeds of that. People were just really frustrated. But I mean, the people who I stayed in touch with didn't think that the Donetsk People's Republic, the people who were leading that, they had no faith in them. But they also didn't really expect much from the Ukrainian leaders, you know, in Kyiv, because after 20 years, what were they doing for them? They hadn't really, life hadn't gotten better. So.
And Brooke, you also mentioned something, and when I was talking to Julia, she mentioned this too, is when the Euromaidan protests first began, there was a lot of cynicism because people thought, oh, these are just paid protesters. Julie, you haven't spoken yet.
Would
you talk a little bit about like when the protests started and what people were saying?
Of course. I actually just wanted to follow up on what David was mentioning with the Orange Revolution. How there was like a general air of pessimism about political activity and you know change. So I entered my service in 2011 in the fall, and Yulia Tymoshenko, the female former prime minister, was jailed at that time. So I would say the beginning of my service, most political conversations tend to be a little more negative. But also the year I was there, the Euro Cup happened. So a lot of nations were coming in, and people are seeing this as a move towards westernization. So throughout my service, things were sort of, people were keeping their excitement at bay because they're skeptical. The Orange Revolution had happened, but no change had truly happened. So there was all these small movements towards westernization, and then during September of 2013, everyone heard about the potential trade agreement with the European Union, and everyone was really excited. Again, they were holding in their skepticism, but there was a general feeling about this is going to make it. This is finally going to free us, and we'll be on the map. And so when that president didn't sign that and signed closer ties with Russia, that's when everything sort of started going downhill. The young people started to protest because they felt like this wasn't right. And then the older people who had seen the Orange Revolution, they were still disillusioned. They're like, what's the point? We've tried this. But the turnaround here is just like things escalated and they became more violent, but then people wanted their voices heard. They wanted something that was not like the Orange Revolution. They didn't want their voices to die out. So I think that was the main difference. Initially, people were skeptical due to their past experience with the Orange Revolution. So no one really saw this turn that would happen with Molotov cocktails and extreme violence. It was just completely surprising.
That's kind of interesting because when I read media in the United States, they put, when that treaty was being voted on, there was clear distinctions between the West. People in the West want to move toward the EU. People in the East want to move toward Russia. But, I mean, I see Dave shaking his head. You should talk a little, because that's kind of the narrative that I pick up.
I don't want to start up on a tirade about the media. And the coverage of this entire thing. But, the people in the East, yeah, they were disillusioned, but they wanted something better. I mean, they still want something better. They just want, you know, a peaceful life. They want their children to be able to go to school. They want the roads to work. They just want a normal civil society. And so, you know, if there is some hope in joining the EU, then, well, yeah, I mean, people kind of supported that. I mean, I think one of the reasons why it, you know, it escalated so quickly is that the youth really had, you know, were really fed up. I mean, I was in Sevastopol in 2012 and 2013, working with the youth there. There was a lot of frustration, a lot of pent up frustration, and they had energy, you know, as opposed to the older generation that had gone out and, you know, tried to protest during the Orange Revolution and previously, and they were kind of just, you know, tired out. But the youth, I felt, you know, and they were the, I feel like the majority in the protests, you know, yeah. The college students especially, because they could see that there was no future for them in the system that was present, you know, and so they're the ones who really went out and
That's actually took part. I want to follow up on that, because isn't that the current conflict started, it seems like, well, I wasn't there, but in the Crimea, in Sevastopol, seems ground zero. You saw these media broadcasts talking about, you know, and it's been conflicting, but that universally in Crimea they wanted to be part of Russia. But you were there. Could you talk a little bit about that? That talking to the people that you talked to in your classes about their feelings about going to Russia.
Well, the thing about Sevastopol particularly is it has a relatively long history of Soviet-Russian history. The people there are very pro-Russia. The Russian military is there. It's a very large military base. Obviously, patriotism is very high because there's lots of Russians there. You know, a lot of intermarrying, a lot of relatives who are in the military. So it's a very patriotic town. People see themselves as Russian. And particularly in Sevastopol, people did come from the entire Soviet Union, primarily Russia. They were sent there. And so even if they, you know, eventually became Ukrainians, they were from Russia. And people, you know, there was, you know, I mentioned earlier nostalgia for the Soviet Union. I mean, the people in Sevastopol had nostalgia for Russia. They wanted to be a part of Russia, especially the older generation. Now, the younger generation, at least from what I, you know, heard from talking to people, they respected Russia and they respected the military, but at least the educated ones just wanted, you know, a part in the European Union. They wanted jobs. They wanted to get rid of the corruption. So, I mean, I don't know who took part in the, well, there wasn't really any elections. I mean, essentially, Russia just took over Crimea. But the, you know, the whole that the media covers that they were Russian speaking and that they supported Russia in general, people in Sevastopol and, you know, other large like Yalta were more supportive of Russia.
Yeah, and Crimea actually has a really long history with Russia. Did anybody talk a little bit about that? Because I think Julia, you mentioned people felt that it was a mistake when Russia gave it to Ukraine. Maybe just give a little background history so people understand.
Yeah, because like with Crimea, it's definitely rich in resources. It's a naval port. It's also high in tourism. There's a lot of history there. And then people just like, for them, it's just land of territory. It's just closer to Russia. And it's a big concession. Like, as Ukraine, do you give this area away or do you just take a stand with Russia against that? So that's a lot of the main reasons. It's like, did we just give this place away, or did we, you know, let them do what they truly wanted? Because, as David mentioned, like, you don't really know about the elections. The reported result is 96% or 97%.
It's totally bogus.
Yeah, exactly. The number was very high and said, like, a lot of people wanted to be back with Russia. But even though they're now there, things have not improved in the way that they wanted.
And Morgan, sorry, could you talk a little bit about the people discuss politics in your region in Western Ukraine?
Well, I'm going to go back to Dave's comment about the younger generation. When I first got there, you know, my heart and focus was working with kids. And I was fortunate enough to live with a host sister who spoke really good English. She studies at the university in Kyiv. And she actually took part in the protests and camped out in Kyiv for about 2 months. But when I first met her, she was really reluctant, she was shy, she didn't really have opinions, didn't think outside the box. And with her and the students that I worked with, I always pushed them to make them think why they thought the way they did, because I felt the older generation, they actually said, well, it's been working this way for this long, we're just going to keep doing that. And the kids, when I first started working with them, kind of had the same mentality. They, you know, they're just like, we're just going to cheat in school because it's okay. Then you ask them, like, what are you going to get out of it? Like, what are you learning? What are you going to do when you're older? How is change going to happen if you don't change yourselves? And to see the younger generation actually step up and take part in just saying, like, enough's enough, was actually really cool, and to have my host sister being one of those people and to get her insight, it was really neat to see that change happen.
Did any of you go to a Euromaid protest?
Unofficially, actually, I did in the earlier period, in the late November, early December period, when it was just very much a protest. There had been an incident with... it was the first incident of riot police being a group of students. But, you know, at the time, that didn't really escalate the level of violence. It just kind of was just kind of a catalyst for more support.
Yeah, and my village in Western Ukraine was about 25,000 people. And it starting about in January, about 300 people every day would go there after work to just kind of protest in the city center. And ironically, it was the same time that I would go out for a walk every day in that area, so I didn't partake in the protest. However, I was able to see what was going on and be aware of what's going on in my community.
Would you say, now some people, the volunteers who served in the East, you're saying that the young people were supportive of the Euromaidan protests. Is that accurate?
Well, I was referring to my students in Kyiv at university, but as far as... people in the Eastern Ukraine at the time when it began, it kind of goes back to the disillusionment comment. I was speaking with some friends and colleagues that I still had in Eastern region about the Euromaidan protests in general, trying to gauge their opinion. And I think, like I told you when we spoke before, they said, oh, they're paid. It's all just for show. They're paid. And I said, why? This was ages before there was any of the propaganda about, you know, it being a CIA coup or with paid volunteers. This was in November, December. And their reasoning was they have to be paid. Why would people live outside in sub-zero temperatures for weeks and months on end when they've already seen what happened in the Orange Revolution? You've seen that you just can't change anything. So, you know... They were so disillusioned that I think they were just almost, it wasn't that they were just, they just weren't able to perceive it as anything other than a farce because they didn't believe that much conviction could exist, I think, in the early stages.
Do you think some of your students, like, in the East, do you think some of your students traveled to Kyiv to take part in that, or did they do local protests? Were there other protests outside of Kyiv?
Well, there was protests all over Ukraine. Majority of cities in the East, I mean, everywhere, East, West, North, South, there were protests. I mean, some of my students, well, former students who are now in university, were in Kharkiv. Kharkiv's a big university town. And there were pretty large protests in Kharkiv. And, you know, my students took part in those protests. You know, I'm in touch with them on social media, and they were protesting and, you know, taking part in that. And the other thing I have to say in terms of just people I know who took part in the protests, where, you know, there was a lot of these anti-protests, and a lot of people were paid to do the anti-protests. But some of those got kind of violent, and I don't know exactly when, but one thing that kind of showed the Ukrainian patriotism was the football team clubs, the fan clubs. I'm sure you are somewhat familiar, perhaps, with, like, England and their fan clubs, their football, you know, soccer fan clubs. Like, they're really fanatical about football, right? Soccer. Well, when I was in Ukraine, I went to a lot of the Shakhtar Donetsk, where the Euro Cup was played, their team. And, you know, the fan club consists of high schoolers, college students, you know, men of middle age. And, you know, so it's sort of a real cross-section of society, at least from the male side. And eventually, when the protests started getting violent in Donetsk and in Kharkiv, the fan clubs from the football teams came out and protected the Maidan, like the Euromaidan protesters, from like the pro-Russia or anti-Maidan protesters. So that was kind of interesting.
Anybody have to add on to what David said? So how did things go? So you have the Maidan protests, and then you have the issue with Crimea. How did people react when Russia made its move? Well, I don't want to say Russia, but when Crimea held their referendum, how did people react to that? What did they say to you?
Well, I know for me, when I saw everything on the news, I immediately contacted all my friends in Ukraine, and to hear the comments from the people in my town in the West, you know, they didn't know what was going on. There's talk of a draft. There's, you know, they thought they were going to war. There's all this confusion. Then I talked to my host family in the North, and they didn't know what was going on, but they told me a completely different story from my connections in the West. And then talking to other volunteers, like everyone in Ukraine in all different regions had a completely different story. No one really knew what was going on. There's no legitimate source. And then I think because social media is so big nowadays, it was easy for the people to just take out their cameras and just start videoing what was happening on the streets, and that's where people started getting their information from.
I just wanted to say about the media, because until, I guess, probably, I don't know, December, when the protests got violent, the media, at least the Ukrainian and the Russian media, were fairly unbiased, I'd say. I mean, they were just reporting facts. But once the protests actually became real and there was a real movement in Ukraine, the Russian media just started churning. I mean, it was a real, like, propaganda. I think it was a real... They were just churning out lies. I mean, literal lies. And so a lot of people in the East actually don't speak Ukrainian. And they have actually, and especially the older generation, might even have trouble understanding Ukrainian. And so they get all their news sources from Russia, Russian TV sources. And a lot of people, it's not like an internet-savvy country. I mean, people aren't connected like we are here. So it's only like the younger generation and the educated that are, you know, looking at social media and seeking out, you know, other alternative sources of media. And so, like, the majority of people were just, you know, listening to what was coming on from Russia, which was just like total garbage. And then, you know, then the younger generation is looking at Facebook and Kontakt and all of their, and YouTube, and, you know, just trying to see, like, what's happening from talking to people in social media. So it's kind of, you know, very different pictures all over the country, for sure.
And Julia, when I was talking to you about the annexation of Crimea, you were mentioning one of the protests that some towns were doing is they had their statues of Lenin and they were pulling them down. Maybe talk a little bit more about, like, what you saw in your communities, how they showed their feelings toward what was going on with the Crimea.
Mm-hmm, of course. So the Lenin statue in my town is still safe. He's perfectly fine. But the neighboring ones have been pulled down and crushed to pieces. And I know this because we live in a region and volunteers would call each other. And I remember someone telling me, like, oh, by the way, Virginia's town, they tore down her Lenin statue. We're like, oh, security threat. Everyone leave. But it was fine. What happens was, you know, people just get riled up and they hear it and people gather together. Like the football clubs, they are really popular. Like the men just, like, you know, they go to a place, they sit and they talk and they feel frustrated. And then when movement gathers together with enough frustration, they do take action. And when they see other regions doing it, they join in. I think Kharkiv was one of the first ones to pull down the Lenin statue, and that was a major milestone. So smaller towns, ones who, like, felt super strongly about the Ukrainian independence movement, they would join in and destroy their statues in solidarity.
Yeah, just to kind of to build on that, had I not been fortunate enough to return to Ukraine in a private capacity following the evacuation, my last night in Ukraine would have really been a great memory probably for the rest of my life. Actually, a few hours before I realized I was going to be evacuated, I actually attended the town square where they took down the Lenin statue in my town. And it was just this really kind of moving, almost surreal event. The people, many people had tried and failed to bring it down using just, chains and ropes and things like that. And actually the city council actually ordered some construction equipment we brought to help them. And so, at that time, I really just viewed that as like, okay, this
where's
is...
Where's your town, by the way?
It's in central Ukraine, a college town right in the Kyiv region. Geographically, it was kind of, to go back to the terms of geography and just kind of make it that simple, it was kind of in the heart of the Maidan movement. But, the craziest thing about the event was it was actually organized. The person, kind of standing up on the statue with a megaphone giving orders was a priest. And I just thought, where am I? There's a priest standing next to a Lenin statue, and probably one of the most famous atheists in the history of the world, ordering it to be brought down, telling people what to do. At the end of it, when it was brought down, he ordered that it was actually a bronze material. It couldn't be broken up like into rocks, which a lot of people were really disappointed because people had their sledgehammers and everybody wanted a souvenir. But he was there also, the priest was there to say, we're not going to destroy it. It's going to be melted down and given to, I think it was the orphanage he wanted to donate the money to. So it was just a really great memory and personal experience I'll never forget.
So actually, we're kind of running a little bit low on time here. And so I want to get to the volunteers who were evacuated. So as things were heating up, tell us a little bit about how Peace Corps was reacting at this time. And when did you start feeling like your time might be limited?
Yeah, I think in November was when Peace Corps really started to not necessarily take very severe precautions, but kind of just let us know, hey, like the next step, this is the next step that we'll go to as far as safety and security reasons. And with that, from November all the way up till the end of February, there were travel restrictions on where you could go, who could go, how long, and that sort of thing. And then I would say at the beginning of February was when they kind of started to tell you, it's about time to pack your entire apartment just in case, be prepared. So there were a few weeks where you're going to school not knowing, am I getting evacuated and waiting on a phone call, which is really stressful because with that you can't tell people where you're going in your community for safety reasons. And so, when we got the word, you just kind of had to disappear and then do the damage control later.
Yeah. Exactly. I guess I really understood that it was a possibility and was probably going to happen when I got a call to set up kind of a special, I guess, contingency plan for myself because I was in a relatively unique situation and that I couldn't get to my predetermined safe point without going directly through central Kyiv. So I was contacted in the middle of February about a possibility of being able to actually get myself to the airport without, kind of being able to stay on the fringes of the thing without actually going through the proper Peace Corps channels. And I knew if they were going to the point to organize something like that with me, then it was a very real possibility. And like I said, like the really long story I just got finished telling, I was kind of on a cloud at the moment. I really thought things were heading in the right direction, and then like it kind of just came out of nowhere because it really did seem the last few days before the evacuation like things had taken a positive step. They had just impeached Yanukovych, and the parliament had just passed a lot of resolutions and things, giving amnesty to Euromaidan protesters and opening inquiries about the shootings and things like that. And it just kind of looked like, things had kind of taken a very small step, but at least in the right direction. So I was really hopeful when it kind of came out of nowhere for me light of the recent events.
So you were surprised when you got the...
Yeah, I had kind of accepted it, and then, things started to change for the better for the first time in weeks or months, and I'd kind of thought, we may just make it through this thing, and I was really, kind of be excited to be, like, in the epicenter of everything that was going on, and almost, even though I'd accepted it as a possibility, I couldn't really believe that it would happen until it actually did.
Yeah, and Kayla, you mentioned that you could not, Peace Corps is going through all these discussions with you, and then also telling you can't tell anyone you're on the verge of leaving.
Right, exactly, for safety and security purposes. That way, they consolidate you by region. So in my group, there were about 20 of us that met up in the capital. And so just having a large group of Americans, for safety and security purposes, we were told to just leave most of our belongings behind and pack a small bag and show up at the Capitol and wait for further instructions.
What time of day did you get the call?
I was at school, so you know when you're trying to teach a class and your cell phone goes off and then you get the you just see the phone number and you just know. So it was about 10 in the morning, and it was also fairly snowy in my region at the time, so they knew that it would be highly unlikely for us to make it that evening. So they gave us the rest of the day to kind of gather our belongings, and we headed out early the next morning.
Yeah, I found out it was very late in the evening. I think it was 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening, and I'd actually missed the email because I was at the statue, you know, festival. So I got a phone call, and that was just because of, you know, in order to keep everyone safe, they evacuated the ones closest to the airport most convenient first because they could kind of get them out really soundlessly kind of in the dead of night without raising a lot of alarm. And then, you know, the people that had a much more difficult situation like she did, they had to be a lot more careful.
Yeah, and there were talks of trying to charter a flight, because we had over 220 volunteers, but it was at the same time as the Sochi Olympics, and so planes weren't easy to come by. So you have groups flying out of Moldova, mm-hmm. Vienna, some groups even went to Turkey, so people were flying out from all over, and it was rather chaotic.
So would you go back? I'll just go down the line. Would you go back?
Well, I actually just got my luggage 2 days ago, so I was about ready to go back to Ukraine and grab my luggage, but it's finally here. It's definitely one of those things that I would love to go back and visit my friends and people who I consider family now, but as far as going back and working at my school, I think that being evacuated kind of ruined some of those relationships and friendships at my school, and now with it being over half a year, it's just things are different, so... Definitely would love to go back and visit, but as far as go back and be a Peace Corps volunteer, I'm not so sure.
But you've already been back.
Yeah, you know, fortunately, I did have the opportunity to go back after we were evacuated for a few months, and it was kind of a really intense situation at the time because it was during the anti-terrorist offensive and things like that. But as far as going back, I had the opportunity to assist a Peace Corps team from Washington when I was there who sent a security assessment team for the prospect of returning volunteers to some regions in Ukraine, possibly west and some central Ukrainian sites. Everything I heard from them was really positive. They seemed to think that Ukrainian people had the situation at hand, that it was secure, and that you know, the time may be right for, you know, in very isolated instances to have volunteers working in Ukraine once again, because, you know, what better time really for Peace Corps to be there than now? But it actually kind of broke my heart a little just a few months ago when I found out that Peace Corps had made the decision to hold off and just kind of see what happens, at least until after the new year. So I was really probably in a position to go back right up until then, but, you know, I would definitely go back if the opportunity was perfect, and I'll go back to visit. But like she said, it'll just never be the same again. It'll just never quite be the same.
Well, Dave, I know you.
Well, I mean, I've been back a lot. My wife is here. She's from Ukraine. So we've gone back a lot to Ukraine. And we were there in Crimea last year. So I don't know if I can go back to Crimea in any sort of official American policy for the time being. The one thing that's kind of, I guess, sad is that we went back in June, and just because of time and other things, because of this, the instability there, I didn't go to Debaltseve, which is where my service was. And now, I mean, I don't even know if I can, you know, could ever go back there. I don't know what's going to happen. They got bombed 2 days ago. So, you know, they're like right on the edge of sort of the separatist controlled territory and then the Ukrainian army controlled territory. So it's pretty sad.
Yeah, I would definitely love to go back. I think it's true right now. There's a ceasefire. There's a lot of violence going on. But personally, there's the hopeful side of me that in the end, in the long game, this will be a better, you know, world for Ukraine. And I would love to go back and see my students when they're adults and they're 30 and just see what this change, what this fight led to see if they truly were able to build, if not better lives for themselves, than the next generation.
Same with Julia. For sure, I'd go back.
Okay. So now we'll open up for questions.
So aside from the interesting political situation, what was life like there for you and the families you stayed with?
Yeah, so at the beginning with Peace Corps, you do 2 to 3 months of training, and you all stay with the host family. So everybody, right, correct, stayed mm-hmm. with the host family. And my host family at the beginning was a 65-year-old couple who spoke Syrgyzik, which is a mix of Ukrainian and Russian. So I would go home so excited to use my Ukrainian words, and then they would yell at me something, and I'd be like, I don't know what that means. That's the whole part of living with a host family is learning new words and learning about the culture. And then after that, I moved to a village far away and had a 2-bedroom apartment to myself. So quite the change, but I missed my host family and visited whenever I could.
Yeah, really exactly the same situation as her. I got spoiled by having a host family, a middle-aged couple take care of me for a few months and then had to go live on my own. So I never ate nearly as well or was as healthy as I was those first few months. I know most people probably realize that in Ukraine it's not what we're used to as far as children, growing up and leaving the home. And they're used to having people that were our age, out of college, mid to late 20s, even in some cases, still be children at home. So they very much looked at us as children and part of the family. So most of us who had experiences living on before, we kind of had this experience of rejoining a family and becoming part of a family. And I know most people do, and I definitely did. You kind of considered this your family throughout your whole service. You called them on the holidays and checked up on them, and you went home, when you were hungry a lot of times, whenever you had the opportunity, you visited just like you would your family here in America.
I actually lived with two host families when I was in training for 3 months, and I still stay in touch with them. But then when I moved to my town, I lived with the host family for 5 months and really became a part of their family. I'm friends with their sons and daughters and worked with their relatives. Really kind of became like a member of the family. Ukrainians are very, very hospitable. They're very curious. They love, they loved having me. They loved questioning me. They loved feeding me. They love celebrating holidays. They love spending time around the table just talking and socializing. The emphasis on the family is really, really important. And so I think that's why a lot of us had really great experiences with our host families.
Yeah, I think like with the host families, my landlord, we were just definitely surprised at the different lifestyles we led. For example, they were surprised like, oh my God, you know how to use Microsoft Excel. Did you have to go to university? I'm like, no, everyone kind of knows how to use Microsoft Excel. But then they would stare at me like, Julie, why don't you know how to rewire a toaster using a butter knife? I'm like, oh. We just don't learn about these type of things. Knives are illegal. I have no idea. I was just telling another member of the audience, my landlord walked down the road carrying a scythe. I'm like, oh my God, what are you doing, sir? He's like, I'm just mowing the lawn. And he shows me how to do it. I just can't. I'm just like pushing the grass around. And he just looks at me and just like, Americans.
For my 2-year service, I actually lived in an orphanage with about 100 kids. And so that was quite different from the host family experience. I actually lived on the floor with all the girls. And so 6 a.m., I would get knocks on my door. Can you braid my hair? So Ukrainians are very into hair braiding, so I'd braid about 20 girls' hairs every morning. Then at nighttime, it'd be like, can you tuck me in, or I'm scared of the dark, or there's lightning and God's mad at us. So I just dealt with kids for the 2 years, and I absolutely loved it. But as Brooks was saying, a little funny thing, the host family was definitely my family. They adopted me, they took care of me, even when I was maybe 12 hours away. I actually brought back my dirty laundry every holiday to put it in their washer, and my host mom was more than happy to do it. So Ukrainians are very hospitable, and they definitely made my time a once-in-a-lifetime memory.
These are great stories, but tell me, there's a geopolitical concept that's been put into the American press. This is all about just Soviet Union getting a seaport. Would you comment?
You said the Soviet Union getting a seaport?
Yeah, Odessa.
Odessa or Sevastopol.
Thank you for correcting it. Yeah, Sevastopol or Sevastopol.
Well, the Russian Black Sea Fleet has been in Sevastopol.
Maybe I'm incorrect, but just would you clarify?
Yeah, the Russian Black Sea Fleet is in Sevastopol. The Ukrainian government renewed the contract amid protests, I think, three years ago.
2010, yeah.
For another 20-something years, yeah. 20, 30 years or something like that. So the Russian military had been, or the Russian government had been renting, paying the Ukrainian government, more corruption, to use the base in Sevastopol. So they didn't, and I mean, the Ukrainian military worked right alongside with the Russian military. I mean, the Ukrainian naval base was right there, and the Russian naval base was right there.
That's not a major issue.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Yeah.
I suppose my wife and I were lucky in having sailed down the Dnieper from Kiev to Odessa and then over to Crimea in 2011. But I have a historical question. Perhaps the greatest genocide of the 20th century was the killing of 6 million or so Ukrainian kulaks under Stalin back in the 1930s. Has there been any, is there any fallout from that nowadays?
Unfortunately, not nearly as much as they should be. Very recently, and by recently I mean really the past probably decade, have the Crimean Tartars that have remained in the region actually had any kind of voice. I think just after Ukraine gained independence, it was still another 6 or 7 years, I think, before they were allowed to set up their own version of kind of a parliament. So you're talking only 9 or 10 years ago. Have they actually had their own organization? And just the structure of Ukraine as far as obviously government and even non-government organizations and things that would historical preservation groups, things like that, there just really isn't anything like that there to kind of get that back in kind of the national or definitely global mindset. So it's largely been ignored. Fortunately, a lot of the genocide that took place during the Second World War and during Stalin's various plans has come to light in the last few decades. But unfortunately, the Crimean Tatar genocide is still very much overlooked. And I think even within Ukraine itself, I'm a historian by trade, so anytime I had an opportunity to talk with a history professor at the university or even when I was in a school, I always talked about that, and they could talk for hours and hours about almost everything in the Second World War, all the wrongs, all the rights, but that really even never came up in conversation. I think that kind of really just shows how it was really whitewashed by history, I guess, and how it's really going to take kind of a grassroots movement with some assistance probably from some different organizations to really bring that to public light, and the situation just isn't really conducive to that now, especially in Crimea.
Okay, unfortunately, we've reached a time in our program where we only have time for one more question. And
my question would be, it appeared to me, as in just observing it in the media, and we know how poor that can be, the goings-on, that as things got more serious, the Russian propaganda machine started defining things very definitely on ethnic lines. I mean, there's Russian nationalism, and it reminded me so much of what went on in Yugoslavia, Slobodan Milosevic. You know, once you play that ethnic card, it gets you elected and everybody loves you. When that genie's out of the bottle, you can never get it back in. And I'm curious to hear your response on whether or not anybody could put this Humpty Dumpty back together again should things get better, or is the damage irreparable between the East and the West and the Russian and the Ukrainian speaking? Because of the propaganda being so strong on
the
one side.
Let me
throw
out
the question.
I'm surprised at, a lot has happened in the last year, and a lot of people are name-calling, and there's a lot of mistrust among, from the East and the West, and there's also just a lot of misinformation. And so people from the West, they maybe support the East and they support the people there, but then the people in the East don't hear that, or the people in the West only hear that the people in the East are calling them fascists, but not all of them are saying that, or you know, the people in the West are criticizing the people in the East because they say, well, you voted for these people, and so now get what you voted for. You know, but at the same time, the people in the East are saying, well, we didn't really want to vote for these people. We just wanted to vote for a better life. I don't think the whole, like, you know, Russian versus Ukrainian thing is that big of a deal as much as it is in Crimea, really just in Sevastopol. I mean, even though Tatars are a minority in Crimea, I mean, they still are more, I don't know exactly what's going on right now, but they were more powerful and more organized than before. But I mean, in the East, people, it's not really about Russia versus Ukraine. They just want to live a normal life.
I think if it's one thing in the world that Ukrainians are definitely the best at, they can take whatever's thrown at them and whatever adversity they have, and they can go on with life. So I think they've had that in history, and they've shown they can do it before. So I wouldn't bet against them being able to do it again. If they decide what is what they truly want, then they'll be able to live again as a whole country, I believe.
All right, thank you. Our thanks to Dave Masterson, Kayla Ternichuk, Julia Lee, Brooks Harrison, and Morgan Roth. We also thank our audience here and our listening audience. This event is a collaboration with the Northern California Peace Corps Association, a nonprofit dedicated to promoting understanding between peoples of the world. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California in its 111th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.